Thanks for the introduction. It's my pleasure to visit Perimeter Institute again, especially during the Thanksgiving time for the U.S. Thanksgiving time. So I would like to tell you something about what we can learn from strong gravitational lensing about the distant universe, specifically the so-called cosmic noon that refers to the redshift range between 2 to 4-ish, when the star formation activity of the universe reaches the highest level. Strong gravitational lensing has been a very powerful tool, because when we want to study the distant universe, even our most powerful telescopes are not powerful enough to see things in details. So strong gravitational lensing really augments our capability to study these really distant systems. And for a long time, so I've been thinking, what can we learn from this strongly magnified system, apart from discovering these remarkable examples. So I have been focused quite a lot on this particular system called sunburst arc. So it is a Lyman alpha emitter strongly lensed by a foreground galaxy cluster. And then you can see this arc that is in the shape of a partial Einstein ring. And what is very remarkable is that you can see the details in that galaxy. Without gravitational lensing, that would not have been possible. As we study the details in this galaxy, we kind of unexpectedly find some evidence that very unusual physical processes are happening in the vicinity of a massive young star clusters. As I will explain, this evidence might be connected to a long-standing puzzle about very massive star clusters, namely the apparently multiple stellar populations observed almost in every globular clusters. So this will be the topic. So this will be the topic of my talk today, to give you some background, because I think I don't think many of you in the audience might be particularly familiar with the study of star clusters. So I would give some quick introduction of what are globular clusters and what is really this puzzle of multiple stellar populations, and why we are in general interested in studying superstar clusters, which is basically their the younger version of globular clusters. And then after giving you some of these motivating background information, I will present the recent work I did with a Berkeley graduate student and other collaborators. We did a photometric and a spectroscopic modeling of one very interesting superstar cluster candidate in that sunburst galaxy using archival data. And the goal is to, because the system is not directly resolved, so through this modeling, we want to extract the physical parameters describing the star cluster and its surrounding nebula. And then we give physical interpretation of the measured parameters of the cluster and the nebula. And I will explain why the finding is quite interesting, because we find kind of direct evidence or for some condensed material that is probably coming from massive stars in the young star cluster, and that might be connected to the to the origin of these multiple stellar populations. So globular clusters obviously are the most impressive stellar systems that we can directly see in the Milky Way. So typically, these globular clusters, they hover around in the Milky Way's halo. There are about 200 of them orbiting around the Milky Way. And the most important property is that these are really, really massive and compact stellar systems. They typically have tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of stars, or even millions of stars. All of them are gravitationally bound and tightly packed within a very small volume of just several parsecs across. So these systems are obviously very old stellar systems. Nowadays, we could only see the very low mass stars, because the intermediate mass or higher mass stars, they have died a long time ago. And so this begs the question, what happens at the beginning of these stellar systems? Because obviously, at the beginning, there should be a star cluster of a younger version, which we call a superstar cluster, that probably has at least a million solar masses, or even more than that. And these young systems, there are a lot of interesting astrophysical questions associated with the evolution of those systems. So to name a few, one is that those represent star formation in the highest at highest densities. So the astrophysicists who want to understand how stars form, they are very interested in knowing how efficient such systems can turn gas into stars. And these systems, they form in the very young universe, so they might actually make a very important contribution to the reionization of the intergalactic medium, as recent data suggests. And then these systems, because they're so dense, they are dynamically very interesting. For example, there could be runaway mergers between massive stars within the first 10 million years, and then that leads to maybe either some
Sorry, Asana Lee has a question.
Do these have many black holes? In the end, do they settle down and they produce many black holes?
Yes, exactly, because in the first 10 million years or so, we expect a large number of massive stars which end their lives. So they will become, a lot of them will become stellar mass black holes. And then these stellar mass black holes may quickly merge with each other in the very dense core of the cluster, and may even lead to the formation of intermediate mass black holes. So these are very intriguing systems. In the simple-minded picture, we might think that the entire cluster, they form all of a sudden out of a single giant molecular cloud. And therefore, it is at the beginning very natural to surmise that all of these stars, all of the cluster member stars, they have the same age, and they have also the same chemical abundance pattern. But when people actually measure the chemical abundance of individual globular cluster stars in the recent one or two decades, they found very surprising results. So one way to look at it is if all stars, they just have exactly the same chemical abundance, but they have different initial masses, then you would expect, if you plot things in the color magnitude diagram, which is resembles the HI diagram, then you would like to see a very narrow isochrome. But in the majority of the globular clusters, people typically see this kind of multiple isochrones that can be resolved. And then after they dig into why there are multiple isochromes, clearly it is associated with some chemical spread among the different stars. So for example, people can design different ways to make linear combinations of flux measurement in different filters. And then they carefully design these combinations so that they are sensitive to the abundance of some particular chemical elements that can affect how bright the star is at the photosphere. And when they do so, for example, they discover that these stars, they seem to fall into discrete, multiple discrete groups. So in this example, this color is sensitive to the helium abundance, and this color, this combination, is sensitive to the nitrogen abundance. So people find that some of the stars, their abundance seem to be in agreement with the abundance in the typical ISM at that metallicity. But then there are some other stars that seem to show a very different abundance for these elements. So this is referred to as the multiple stellar population problem in globular clusters. And usually we call, you know, these stars with normal abundance the first generation or first population, and these ones, they are called the second population. But the second population really can have multiple groups. And people have done a lot of work. Oh. It's the log. So usually the abundance is represented as kind of, well, this is, so this is not the abundance. This is just observable. It's some kind of linear combination of the filter fluxes, but then the typical abundance variation depending on which element can vary by like a factor of 10.
And the ratio abundance of the stars themselves in these different populations, they're all equally represented. So see, like the ones that are consistent with being the same chemical composition than the ISM, are those more than the ones that have more nitrogen, or they are the same in numbers there, you see?
Sorry, could you explain a bit more? I didn't get your question.
The number of stars in each population compared. So how many stars do you have in one population and first population, or the different colors, how many do you have in each?
Yeah, so surprisingly, the number of second population stars can even dominate over the number of first population stars. I will have a slide discussing that. And then people have done, over the years, have done a lot of observational work to measure the detailed abundance. And typically what they find is that there's very clear correlation between either the elevation or the depletion between different light elements. So for example, people typically find that the second population stars, they have elevated nitrogen in the atmosphere, but they depleted carbon and oxygen. Although the sum of these three elements, they seem to be pretty much constant. And another very typical anomaly is there is correlation between depleted oxygen and enhanced sodium. And then when people go to even less abundant elements, they also find clear correlation, for example, between depleted magnesium and elevated aluminum. So on the other hand, when you look at heavy elements, which are more associated with pollution by supernova, especially type 1a supernova happening at a much later time scale, there's no evidence that different populations, they are affected differently by supernova explosion. So typically when you measure the iron abundance, it all appears very uniform in a single globular cluster. So these, to just give you some insight, so these correlations that I mentioned, they are clearly connected to a number of hydrogen burning cycles that happen in stars, typically the intermediate mass or massive stars. So they are all associated with proton capture processes that usually operate in cycles. The outcome is to fuse protons into helium, the alpha particle. But then along the way, different light elements, they act as catalysts. And then what happens is that as these cycles start to operate at different hydrogen burning temperature and eventually is driven into a thermal equilibrium, it can turn some of these elements involved into others. So for example, the CNO cycle, which is a very important channel to fuse hydrogen into helium in relatively massive stars, you basically create a lot of nitrogen at the expense of carbon and oxygen. And then there are additional minor cycles, such as one involving neon and sodium and one involving magnesium and aluminum. And typically you deplete one and, you enhance one at the cost of depleting the other. These have been studied and people try to figure out each of these cycles happens at what temperature, which will help us try to determine where this enriched material might come from. So basically, all of this knowledge, the picture is quite clear. That is the second population, their natal material must somehow be polluted by hydrogen burning products and most likely coming from the same star cluster itself. You need a specific type of stars that can process these elements and give the right abundance pattern as observed. So then people also have looked at.
I think Lee has another question, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, sorry. At what redshift are we talking about all this happened?
At what redshift? These are all observations of Milky Way globular clusters because we people need to be able to study individual stars.
So, but what areas are these processes happening?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question very well.
At what time are these processes happening?
At what time? Yeah, that's a good question. So the stars that you need to host these processes, they are no longer alive in the present day globular cluster. So it must have happened at some point in the past. And then, one key question is people want to figure out when, at what stage of the cluster's evolution this happens.
Is it possible for really high speed, like 200?
The sound effect is not very, I could not hear you very well.
Is it possible these are taking place at what would now be high redshift, about redshift 200?
He's asking about the redshift at which processes are happening.
At a water redshift. So the Milky Way's globular clusters, they are very old. So they are forming, for example, at redshift 6 or before that. So that means if you think these are happening within the first hundreds of millions of years, then it must happen before redshift 6. There are also other globular clusters that are slightly younger. So, in fact, my next slide will partially touch this question. So, The other thing people have looked is how this phenomenon empirically depend on the cluster properties. And two of the most important properties, the cluster mass and age. And then they found clear patterns. So first of all, there's a strong dependence on the cluster mass. If we look at so-called open clusters in the Milky Way, those are systems that have typically only thousands of solar masses. They are forming stars, and they are typically not gravitationally bound. The multiple population phenomenon is never observed in those systems. And then when they look at the more massive systems, but an older system, namely the globular clusters, they find that this phenomenon is more prominent for more massive globular clusters. So for the most massive globular clusters, the second population can account for even like 70% or 90% of the surveyed stars. And then if you look at stars in the field, not associated with any star cluster, you find that there is a small fraction of stars that appear to show the similar chemical anomaly. But then people typically think that this means these stars, actually they are originated from globular clusters. They are probably dynamically stripped from those systems. But then the majority of the field stars, they don't show this phenomenon. What is quite odd is that there's no clear detection of age difference between multiple populations, even though they clearly show different light element pattern. The second, and then another, I think, quite curious observational fact is that it is pretty straightforward for people to look at younger versions of massive star clusters and see if there are multiple populations. But so far, people find that all the systems surveyed younger than about 2 giga years, they don't show, there's no clear detection of this phenomenon. But then all the systems older than 2 giga years, as long as they're as massive as like 100,000 solar masses and above, they tend to show this phenomenon. So this is also a curious fact. So people have given a lot of thought to what might have caused this phenomenon. So I would just, so these are not like preliminary ideas. People actually have done very comprehensive studies of different explanations. So I'm just going to give examples of a number of very representative scenarios. So for example, one scenario people propose is that this actually has nothing to do with pollution by certain type of stars, but it just reflects the fact that at the very beginning, there might be a spatial separation or spatial clustering of dust grains versus gas in the molecular cloud, because the dust grains locks a lot of the chemical elements into the solid state. So if then you form stars, you naturally get stars with different abundances. But the, I think a severe problem with this scenario is that if that is the case, then you would basically see a scatter in the abundance relative to the normal, rather than a like one-sided anomaly. So this, I don't think this kind of explanation is favored by people. And another popular scenario is that people think stars whose masses is between some range, 6 to 9 solar masses, when they evolved to the so-called asymptotic giant branch, so the star becomes very hot and very bloated. The star gets very hot in the hydrogen burning area, but then the atmosphere gets very bloated. The star is able to slowly shed material in the form of winds, and the velocity is small enough that the material can easily be captured by the cluster's gravitational potential. When people try to work out this scenario, they find the major problems. For example, the prominent sodium oxygen anti-correlation is not explained by this scenario. In fact, the scenario predicts the otherwise. And then there's the mass budget problem. Without going too much into the details, it's simply this problem that because we get so many second population stars, so any scenario need to provide a sufficient amount of ejected material to account for that. And if you say this can only work with stars between some small mass range, then you run into problem you don't get a sufficient amount of mass. And then there can be some timing problem because this scenario does not operate in the first moment of star cluster formation, but rather after 30 to 100 million years. And then there's another more speculative idea, which is maybe a runaway merger in the cluster center will quickly lead to the formation of very exotic stars called the very massive stars. These stars have masses as high as 1,000 solar masses, and they in fact quickly blow itself apart before it ever gets to the later stage of, for example, nuclear burning. There are many features of this scenario that can be argued to be consistent with data. But I think the major problem is that this star has never been observed anywhere in the universe, so it remains a theoretical speculation. The stellar evolution is highly uncertain.
How much do these statements depend on what is the small scale structure of the power spectrum? So could it be possible if you form structure earlier below a certain scale, all of these things become better?
Do you mean like the
Let's say the power spectrum at, I don't know, below where we measured it now.
The power spectrum of what?
Of dark matter.
Dark matter.
So here I assume you have at all scales this lambda CDM spectrum what's extrapolated from the CMB. What happens if you have more power at smaller scales? For structures of mass of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5 solar masses. What happens if you have more power so these things form earlier? Does that change the story that you just presented, or?
I don't think it would change because this is more about like within a single starburst, somehow the star, their initial chemical abundance appear non-uniform. Of course, I guess you're saying, suppose I have some, I guess, are you saying that I could have formed a lot of small clusters and maybe later on they merge together?
Or the density changes, right? So the density of baryons in those clusters is different.
The density wouldn't affect the light element abundance, I think.
Well, it will affect the processing, right? The time scales change. So when you start forming or cooling, perhaps, things change a bit. Because the density of baryons at inside the cluster is different. So I don't know, because it will affect the timeline of some things.
Yeah, I think at the scale of cluster formation, the physics, I mean, mainly is set by like metallicity. So, because you know, eventually you just get a molecular cloud that kind of fragments and turn gas into stars. So I don't see. I think that scale is so small that I don't see why the power spectrum, matter density power spectrum at the cosmological scale would affect that.
At those scales, let's say you have 200 times the dense desert cluster. At those masses, at the masses that you care about, at 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6.
I think you definitely affect timing. So you're right that if I have a lot of small-scale power, then I might get this first star cluster formed at a higher redshift. But I think that's more or less orthogonal to the chemical abundance problem. Because so the point is, So different star clusters, they obviously can have different metallicities. Some of them are very metal poor, some of them they are less. But this anomaly is not saying I have a range of metallicity in the star cluster. It's saying the star cluster appears to have a single metallicity traced by heavy elements, but then the light elements, they show very weird variation. So what I think are very intriguing scenarios actually involve much more massive stars than these AGB stars. So basically those short-lived stars with masses higher than 20 solar masses. So there are two interesting proposals in the literature. One is that if you get a lot of such massive stars that are rotating very fast, then what happens is that you could form a decretion disk on the equatorial plane, and that disk will lead to slowly ejecting material. So this is good for the gravity to retain whatever is lost from these massive stars. So people have done work showing that in general you can reproduce these specific abundance correlation or anti-correlations. There are some major problems. One is again the mass budget problem, because the total mass of the star cluster, if you assume the standard initial mass function, is dominated not by the massive stars but by the lower mass stars. The second thing is if this thing happens very early within the 10 million years, then there might be problem with why we don't see trace of supernova pollution, because supernova pollution is supposed to produce a lot of oxygen and carbon rather than to deplete them. Another very interesting thing is we know that massive stars, they typically form in binaries. And a lot of those binaries during their later evolution start to interact with each other through mass transfer. And this mass transfer process, people have understood that it's not always conservative. Once the receiver accepts a sufficient amount of mass, it starts to rotate so fast that it's unable to accept more mass. So the remaining amount of transferred mass will just escape the system from the Lagrangian point. And typically those ejection is much slower than other forms of mass ejection. So that's again in the direction of being, being able to be retained in the potential. And then there's, for example, this work by Salma Demink and collaborators that showed that the chemical abundance does seem to match what is observed. So these are what I covered so far are these theoretical ideas. Many of them are successful in explaining some of the facts, but then fail or having difficulty at explaining other facts. So then I can ask a question from a different angle. I can ask, if we believe something is happening when the cluster is very young, can we just directly observe those systems and see what happens? So in the Milky Way, there are not many, but several examples of very young star clusters in the range of a few million years, and they are also very dense. Their sizes are only on the order of 1 or 2 parsec. And when you look at those systems, the problem is observation is very difficult because they happen to hide behind a thick dust reddening. So, you know, you can clearly see that many of these systems appear very red because they're hiding behind some dusty cloud. And the other problem is after people measure their masses, they only have something like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 solar masses. So clearly they cannot evolve into the classic globular clusters.
So can I ask you another question about that? So you may have mentioned before and I missed it. So what is the the initial mass that collapsed to form these clusters? Do they have any idea? Because this counts only the mass in stars?
Yes.
Okay.
So typically that is in the literature, that is called the star formation efficiency. I think that efficiency in the low mass system may be low, maybe 10%. So that means if you get 10 to the 5 solar masses, maybe the initial cloud is 10 to the 6 solar masses. But then in the very massive systems, there are physical arguments to argue that feedback is much weakened. So maybe that efficiency can go up to maybe 50% or yeah, something like that. So this is my favorite picture so far from JWST. This is showing another very young star cluster, not in the Milky Way, but in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So this cluster, it's really a very spectacular example of young how stars they form in a clustered matter in a cluster manner. But even such a spectacular system, the mass is only 10 to the 5 solar masses. So such a system will not evolve into a classic globular cluster that we see. And in fact, I looked into the literature. There's no report of measured anomalous chemical abundances from the gas, from the gas that is scattered around. People did nebular analysis, and there's no report of very significant abundance anomaly. And if you look to the more distant universe, not yet cosmological, but in the, let's say, the low Z universe, you can find examples of starburst galaxies. Many of them are relatively low mass, low metallicity systems. And here I show some example there. Like there are two star clusters. And here it's a more obscured system, but there are several supposed to be very massive star clusters hiding behind the cloudy environment. So these systems start to approach interesting masses a few times 10 to the 5 solar masses, and then in some cases might reach 10 to the 6 solar masses. But observationally, so far, it has been very difficult because we can't resolve individual stars from these systems. And many of them, they are hiding behind highly, very dusty cloud. So we can't even see the stars in the ultraviolet or in optical light. So what has become interesting in recent years, especially after, in this year, after JWST was launched, is that people realize that now if we look at further and further system and even look at the high redshift system with the aid of strong gravitational lensing, we slowly push to the regime that we see young systems that appear to have masses in the range between 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 solar masses. And these young systems now start to approach the proposed globular cluster progenitors. And if you, plot all the stellar systems that people studied in the literature, you find that basically these systems that seem to appear extremely, that seems to be nowhere to find in the local universe, but appear not so rare in the higher redshift of the universe, they seem to be the most massive systems and also the most dense system in terms of the surface density. So reaching something like 10 to the 5 solar masses per square parsec. So it is these systems, maybe we should study them and try to figure out figure out any clue about the puzzle. So okay, so let me go to what we have done about the system we studied. So this is a spectacular gravitationally lensed arc, and there is one superstar cluster candidate that stands out on this arc. What is remarkable is that it has a total of 12 lensed images. So I'm showing 6 in this arc, but there are more on the other part of the arc. And it's very spectacular because if you observe the system in a filter where you are only sensitive to ionizing photon, suddenly everything else fades, but then you see these very localized dots that suggest that the system is leaking directly Lyman continuum radiation that travel all the way from you know, the young universe to Earth. So initial analysis suggests that because the system is so bright, even after accounting for magnification, we still need the system to be at least 10 to the 7 solar masses, but it must be very compact, smaller than 10 parsec, and it must be very young, only like 3 million years old. So we realized that there are a lot of archival data that have not been analyzed by making connection between observable and the underlying physical model. So these include some magnitude measurements in a dozen HST filters and also emission line measurements from spectroscopy from the ground. So led by my student Massimo Pascal, we want to construct a physical model that can explain the observed data, and this physical model tries to address the question, what is the combination of direct starlight and the additional nebula emission coming from that system, and how can we learn about the system's parameters? So let me just explain the general picture, what needs to be done. So the first thing is we need to start with a model that says this is the integrated spectrum of radiation emerging from the stars, from their photosphere. Now, this has been done in the literature, which is called stellar population synthesis. So in particular, we use this latest state-of-the-art model, BPAS, and then we say that we can parameterize the star cluster with two parameters. One is the metallicity of the natal gas that form the stars, and then the other is the age of the cluster. And given these two numbers, we will get a spectrum of the UV and ionizing light that comes out of the stars. And typically, the ionizing light is important because many of it will be reprocessed by the surrounding gas. And then the UV light may be absorbed by surrounding medium if it's dusty, but otherwise it will basically travel to Earth, and we can directly see it. So this is a typical shape of the spectrum coming from from a star cluster. And then the second step is the cluster do not sit in vacuum. It is surrounded by some gas, and this gas is able to absorb the ionizing part of the radiation and then reprocess it into secondary emission. So this requires a photoionization calculation. And the result of this calculation depends on some of the physical parameters of the gas or the nebula. So two of the most important parameters is one is the pressure. If we assume the system is in nearly a hydrostatic equilibrium, then there is a total pressure, and that will determine the structure of the nebula. The second thing is what is the ratio between the incident radiation and the gas density? So that is parameterized by a ionizing parameter U. And once we set this up, the photoionization calculation will tell you to what a degree this gas is ionized as a function of depth. And only the surface layer is photoionized, and the very interior is kind of shielded and remains cool. And this photoionized layer will emit secondary radiation, both in the form of continuum radiation and in the form of emission lines. So these can be these can be calculated, and from which we try to compile a model for the observed spectrum. So one thing we want to take care that people in the literature typically don't do is that the spectrum depends on the viewing geometry in an important way. Because imagine this is the cloud. This side of the cloud is illuminated by the stars. This side is shielded. And depending on where you are looking, you will see very different spectrum. And in a realistic situation, you won't just have one cloud here. You might have a number of different clouds. So you can imagine that what you see is a linear combination of spectrum at different viewing angles. So we try to account for this by introducing additional parameters. For example, what fraction of the solid angle around the cluster is surrounded by these clouds? What is the asymmetry parameter that describes if, you know, if the clouds are located preferentially in the far side or in the near side? And then we see some of the direct starlight, but maybe that fraction is not 100%. Some fraction of the stars are blocked by these clouds. So we introduce these geometrical parameters to make the model more physical. And then we can do additional, we can extract additional parameters of the system. One thing is we can actually measure by, if we can theoretically predict the strength of different emission lines, and by comparing to data, we can measure the abundance of certain elements. So in this study, we the few elements we can measure is carbon, nitrogen, neon, and silicon, and the oxygen and oxygen is basically compared to hydrogen, which mainly sets the metallicity. We find that the model that we introduced before, if we introduce just one characteristic density and the ionization parameter, it has a severe failure. The reason is, on the one hand, some of the emission line ratio can robustly tell us what is the typical density of the photoionizing gas. But then if you assume that is typical of all the clouds, then it clearly underpredicts other emission lines that are kind of suppressed at high densities, and they are stronger at a lower density. So that's why we have this picture that there are probably at least two populations of photoionized clouds. One has higher density and hence higher pressure, and they have higher degree of ionization. The other have lower density, lower pressure, and a lower ionization degree. So this leads to the following results. We simultaneously fit photometric measurement and emission line measurement. These are the photometric measurements. You can see the comparison between measurement and our model, you know, the posterior distribution of our model. So the reason we can get a lot of useful information from even just the photometric data is that some of the, you can see that some of these filters, they happen to be enhanced by strong emission lines. So that makes these data points like the structure of these measurements highly non-trivial. That gives us a lot of information. And then simultaneously, we measure a number of emission lines that we can confidently extract from the data, and we can kind of fit using this model. We can fit. We found that we can perfectly fit this emission line strength. And then depending on which line it is, there are several groups. Some of the lines are sensitive to only the high pressure population. Some of the lines are sensitive to only low pressure population, and some of them are sensitive to both. But we are able to basically fit all of these lines. So then this global fit allows us to extract the key information. So first, about the star cluster, we kind of independently verify that the cluster has an age between 3 to 4 million years. The cluster has a metallicity that is not very low, but subsolar, like similar to Magellanic Cloud type of system. And then up to an unknown magnification factor, which we cannot yet trust from this lens modeling, from these global lens models, the mass has to be at least 10 to the 7 solar masses, but perhaps even larger by a factor of few. Another thing is we kind of confirm that it doesn't appear that the system on the large scale is very dusty. So the host galaxy is not very dusty. So these are all just some confirmation with previous study that we try to convince ourselves that our modeling makes sense. Now, then we can extract a lot of physical properties of the nebula. So one important parameter is this pressure that is remarkably high. It's rarely found in star-forming regions. So this suggests that the system, these high-pressure clouds, they must be located very close to the star cluster, because otherwise you would not reach such high pressure. And then this sets a upper bound on the size of the star cluster, and that translates into a surface density that is very high, 10 to the 5 solar mass per square parsec, that actually saturates the empirically inferred limit for the surface density of any stellar system that we find in the universe. So this suggests that such a system might be the kind of the densest star-forming systems that the universe has across its history. And then we also infer that this low-pressure cloud must be located at larger distances. So that's why the ionizing flux is low and the pressure is also lower. And then simultaneously, we get these geometrical parameters. We find that basically the high-pressure clouds seem to cover maybe half of the solid angle. The low pressure clouds seem to cover a smaller fraction. And then the point is the system is not entirely surrounded by all clouds. There has to be about 10 to 50% of the line of sight that allows radiation to just directly escape. And then particularly along the line of sight, we infer such an escape fraction to be very high, 35 to 75%. So this is perfectly consistent with the fact that we see direct Lyman continuum radiation and agrees with previous results. So what we think is the most interesting discovery is coming from the chemical abundance. So we find that carbon and the neon, they don't look in any way special, but we detected a very strong nitrogen line that, according to the photoionization calculation, can only be accounted for if nitrogen is enhanced by a factor of about 10 relative to the normal, the expected abundance. And in fact, because we introduced two populations, we can even say that the nitrogen is enhanced in the high pressure population of clouds, but they must not be enhanced as much in the low pressure population. So this is consistent with the picture that perhaps the high pressure clouds that are nearest to the cluster is somehow polluted by massive stars, but the more distant gas is less polluted. Another thing we find is that the dust, the cloud is probably dusty because gas phase silicon is depleted. So this cannot be explained by stellar nuclear synthesis processing, but it must be that dust grains they form in the interior of the cloud because the density is so high and that it locks up these refractory metals. So the reason, you know, this dust formation is important is because only if the cloud is dusty, it can become self-shielding. Because otherwise, the intense UV light in the environment will just penetrate the entire cloud, and that will forbid any further molecular formation, and it will not allow a condition to form stars. So I think the evidence that the cloud is dusty is very important for the question whether or not such a dense cloud can lead to a secondary star formation. And then this is just showing how unusual the nitrogen enrichment is. So if you make a compilation of typical H2 regions, and then you show the ratio between nitrogen to oxygen and the metallicity, you find that there's a clear trend with some large scatter, but then what we infer for this system is just way above, is way beyond this range. So clearly, this is a localized phenomenon. Only in the vicinity of the star cluster, this pollution is happening. We even find astrometric evidence that there are two nebula, because in one filter, it just happens that the flux is dominated by one strong emission line. So when you look at that filter, you clearly see that there is a resolved component. So we try to fit it with two components and find that it can largely agree with the parameters that we infer from the photoionization modeling. And if you compare this to what the object looks like in other filters, for example, this filter has zero nebula contribution, so it looks more kind of roundish. And this filter has some level of nebular contribution, so it looks more like extended along the magnification direction. And then this is another filter where it's again just a continuum and with very good angular resolution, so you don't see a similar component that is such extended. So this seems to confirm our inference about the geometry of the system. And then we also try to do some checks, for example, varying the initial mass function. We consider what if there's only just one component instead of two components, or what if it's not an instantaneous starburst, but rather a continuous star formation. And we find that the results are, so it doesn't change the, it doesn't change those important results that I just mentioned. It's not sensitive to these details. Okay, so here's the dynamic consideration for this gas. Because we want to know how much mass is locked up in this photoionization cloud. That's an important parameter. But the uncertainty in that estimate is the column, so how thick the cloud is. The column cannot be directly observationally inferred. The reason is only the surface layer is ionized and is active. The interior has no external energy input, so will not generate any emission that we can detect. So, however, we have a dynamic consideration, which is if the column is too small, then if you calculate the radiation pressure, you find that the radiation pressure should just quickly eject all such clouds on a time scale much shorter than the dynamic time scale of the cluster. So this requires that the cloud has to have a log column density larger than 22.5. And if you plug in that, you find that the cloud mass is, you know, if you take 10 to the 23 as the fiducial value, it's 3 times 10 to the 5 solar masses. So it has to have at least 10 to the 5 solar masses in these dense clouds. And that's interesting because that's a lot of mass budget to for star formation. And then, but then if you assume such cloud is efficiently mixed, and you tend to think so because it's very thin, there's turbulent motion. So then the polluted nitrogen amounts to something like 200 solar masses. That's a lot of nitrogen. That suggests that whatever mechanism is at play here, the efficiency of retaining nitrogen in the vicinity has to be very efficient, because even the entire cluster can only produce up to 1,000 solar mass of nitrogen. So we estimate that if the column density is larger than 24, larger than 24, then probably stars will form inside, given that it's dusty. But on the other hand, if it's really thoroughly mixed, there's probably not enough nitrogen yield. So that means it is still not clear whether or not these clouds, they can actually form stars. Okay, so this study just backs has some implication for for what happens to these young systems in their vicinity in the first few million years. And it also backs a number of questions. So through this work, we have shown that even though these systems, they are so far away, so seemingly we can only get very limited information from those systems, we can still do very detailed modeling and extract a lot of the physical parameters. And those informations, they seem very interesting. And this localized nitrogen pollution seems to be a very intriguing indication. We argue that it must be very common in the vicinity of newborn, but a very massive systems, because this lens, this example is just a randomly selected example. There's no reason why we should be so lucky. Regarding what is the origin of these clouds, I favor that it must be something related to the hydrogen burning product of massive stars in the first few million years, but probably not related to supernova explosion, because supernova explosion will enrich carbon and oxygen, which we don't see in the through modeling of the nebula. But then there are a lot of dynamics questions about how does the physics work? How is the ejector retained in the cluster's potential? One way is that the cluster may start out slow, so then it never escapes the potential. But there's another possibility, which is called a catastrophic cooling. It means that imagine you have some hot gas that blows out fast. Normally, it will not be retained in the potential. But if the system is dense enough, meaning that the hot gas, the density reaches some critical value, it could be that the radiative cooling time scale is faster than the dynamic time scale. So before the gas gets expelled, it actually cools down and condenses. So it loses the kinetic energy and stays in the potential. So it's interesting to understand whether or not this could be happening.
But this is just potential from stars. Or actually, it won't even fragment because it's the so it would just form a bubble. It wouldn't stay there, right?
It might cool down to about 10 to the 4 Kelvin, where the because the cooling rate first increases and then decreases. So it might cool from X-ray gas down to like typical temperature for photoionization gas, but then it might stay there. It might be unable to further. Yeah. So I think in order to form star, you need to further cool to like a molecular cloud temperature. So. Yeah. So maybe I can go back to this cartoon. So what I'm saying here is that so. I draw these these orange stream lines, right? So the meaning of this is there's a lot of mass that we think should be lost in the form of stellar wind or other forms of fast ejecta. So what happens is this matter, they first, you know, because they are coming from many different stars, so they first kind of run into each other, and then they quickly thermalize. And then that leads to very high temperatures, like millions of Kelvin or even tens of millions of Kelvin. So then that leads to the formation of a hot gas. People call it cluster gas or cluster wind. If this gas is unable to cool, then it will quickly stream out of the system through the hose. But however, if this gas is subject to catastrophic cooling, before they manage to leave, they might actually cool already here. They condense already here. And then they lose most of the kinetic energy, because the reason in the case without cooling they move so fast is because the pressure does work. So, you know, if you start with a hot gas, then it's kind of explodes, right? So the cooling may change that picture. And and then, you know, how the clouds can actually survive radiation destruction. I claim that if the column density is high enough, then gravity can pull the cloud back. But in a realistic situation, you always have some weak points. You know, you have some cloud. Maybe the bulk of it has sufficiently large column, but some corner of it has low enough column that radiation pressure will just eject things. So in this way, the radiation can still slowly destroy these clouds. So how does the cloud actually survive such an environment is not a trivial problem. So I think some, you know, numerical simulation using radiation hydrodynamics might be the ultimate way to like address this question. So I think this is what I want to say.
In your analysis, you give a good constraint on the age of the cluster. Could you explain again where does the constraint come from?
Yeah. So the age, the reason is as the system, so the system's spectrum evolves very quickly as you as it goes from like the first 1 million year all the way to 10 million years. So basically, okay, I think this other slide might be the best. So an important parameter is the relative ratio between the ionizing radiation, which will power nebular lines, and the UV radiation. When the cluster is young, this portion is very large. But very quickly, this portion weakens. So to first order, the age can be constrained by seeing the relative, you know, the relative importance between UV radiation and ionizing radiation. But then there's also additional information regarding the details, like, you know, the slope. So the UV slope that people talk a lot about in the literature, this slope, when the system is very young, is the steepest. But then as the system evolves through the first 10 million years, it kind of the slope becomes shallower. And also, you know, there's this contribution, this nebular continuum contribution that we cannot ignore. This contribution is coming from the photoionized cloud that has recombination going on. And this recombination generates continuum radiation. When the system is very young, this component with this cliff is very strong. But then when the system becomes older than about 5 million years, this component becomes kind of negligible. So all of this information put a constraint on the age, together with other parameters. So we find that this age is like it has a spread, but it's typically between 3 to 4 million years.
Okay. So just make sure I got I think you said this, but I want to make sure I got the main message. So you have evidence here that migration is happening very early because you've been able to see the special system where you can extract information out.
Right.
But having done that, right, does this say anything? Does it help you decide which of the mechanisms is responsible for that separation?
Not yet, because we need to determine whether or not. I think there are several things to be determined through further work and perhaps through more data. So one is that whether the cloud, what's the column density? This is a very important parameter, because if column density is high enough, you could argue stars must form through genes instability. So it would be useful to constrain this column, and I think JWST offers this infrared capability to measure dust emission. So the dust emission might hold a clue to the column density. The second thing is, I think here we only get some answer for the nitrogen. So we only find that the nitrogen abundance is anomalous, right? But we are not yet able to measure a number of other things, such as in the globular cluster observation, people measure sodium, they measure magnesium, aluminum, and so on. These, so far, we cannot get those because those are weaker lines. The other thing I think is interesting to get iron measurement, because iron is supposed to be a robust indicator of the primordial metallicity. So it might be interesting. So it might be, I think it's useful to try to get a better measurement of these abundances using more data. So currently we only get this very clear enhancement of nitrogen, but more. So that's why I say it. I think it seems to favor the massive star story, but whether or not it's convincing evidence, I cannot say that it is yet convincing evidence. But it does say that we should study these gravitationally lensed system, because we just can't find them, find examples of those that we can directly measure the vicinity in local universe. So it's a little bit counterintuitive because they are nearby, but the problem is those systems, they rarely form in the nearby universe, because there's just no such high density environment anymore.
Thank you. Cool.